Well, good morning. It's kind of late in the day for me, at least in according to the last week I had some early mornings, but it's still morning and it's still good. If you have your Bible, you can turn to the book of Ruth. It's between Judges and 1 Samuel, and I love these little books in the Old Testament. You guys know a while back we went through Jonah. The short books, short chapters, you could probably sit down and read it in about 15 minutes. And they're absolutely jam-packed. And I enjoy them. I like to teach them. I like to talk about them. I like to read them. I like to be encouraged by them, and I hope that we'll be encouraged today as we start our study in the book of Ruth. If you have kids today, we have a nursery for the younger kids, and we have a preschool room for the kids that are older than the nursery kids, up to about kindergarten or so. And we'll have teachers back there. They'll keep an eye on them if you need a place to send them for a little bit. So I'm really excited to study the book of Ruth. Like I said, Ruth is one of the women named in the genealogy of Jesus. And I'm just fascinated by that. And if you look in Matthew 1, the genealogy of Jesus from Adam all the way to Jesus is told. And four women are named, Perez, Tamar, Ruth, and Uriah's wife. And what's interesting about the naming of these women, they're significant, but they're not necessarily the model, perhaps, that church people might choose or the religious people of the day might have chosen. But God holds them and esteems them enough to name them to remind us that they have a hand or a part in the lineage of bringing the Messiah into the world. So the story of Ruth, like I said, it comes from the time. Let's read verse 1, and that gives us a lot of background, and I'll break that down for you. So I want to kind of go through verse by verse, section by section, and I think it has a lot to say to us today. Sean, in the opening, he talked about how it's a redemption story, it's a love story, there's a husband and a bride, and when we see that in the Old Testament, there's many times that that's a picture of Christ in the church, and the New Testament writers point that out to us. And so there's just a lot going on here. It is a love story. It's a story that I appreciate because it has, you know, a heroic female lead, and it also has a heroic male. It has people of good character doing from unexpected places, doing unexpected things, and we see God working through it. So we see the providence of God, the goodness and the sovereignty of God. We see God in control, orchestrating events that even though are at the time painful or difficult, ultimately lead to not just the redemption of the participants, but also future redemption for the world. And so God is in control, we can know from that, and God is working on our behalf, and he's moving in good ways, even through bad times. And so we see that, but the events in the book from unbelieving outsiders could be termed, you know, coincidences. We see the natural way of things. We see God moving in natural ways. You don't really see big supernatural miracles, but you clearly see God's hand at work, achieving his purposes. Ruth 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. All right, so chapter 1, verse 1 sets the stage. It says it's in the days when the judges ruled. Between Joshua and Saul becoming king, it was a period of judges. There were judges, there were leaders of the people of Israel of, you know, varying degrees of quality and character. And you see, oftentimes in the book of Judges, it says the people did what was right in their own eyes. My wife and some of her Bible study people just went through Judges, right? And you see that happening. People doing what's right in their own eyes. And so this is going on. This is placing it. And it's written after the events because it in the end we'll see it references King David. So it's setting up the greatest king of Israel, the greatest period of prosperity where Israel realizes God's promises most obviously on earth. And so it's setting that up and setting the stage. So the judges rule. There's a famine in the land. So they're in the promised land, but they're experiencing famine, which would probably indicate that there's been a falling away, which happened often in the book of Judges. Not living up to the covenant, not being faithful to God, to the covenant with God. And a famine comes as a sort of judgment, but as a, you can think of it as a refining or a pruning. There's another metaphor I want to reference here in a little bit from Jeremiah. And the man from Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. So Moab is a place across the Dead Sea from Israel. If you have a map in your Bible, or you can look that up. So they're sojourning. They're leaving the promised land. They're leaving the place God had told them to settle and to rest. And they're going to Moab. And the history of Moab is interesting. If you read it, interesting to say the least, I guess, troubling, disturbing. If you know your Bible in Genesis 19, the story of Lot, you may know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm just going to read it to you. So I'll just read it here. So now Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. So what was Lot's decision-making was based out of what? He was afraid, okay? He lived in a cave with his two daughters, and the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there's not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father." So that's what happened. First, the older daughter, and then the younger daughter got their father drunk, lay with him, and had children. The firstborn bore a son, called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites. The younger bore a son, named him Ben-Ammi. He's the father of the Ammonites. So what we see, even at the origins of the destination that they're going to Moab. The origins, the history, the root of Moab comes out of decision-making based out of fear and desperation, okay? So Lot makes a decision out of fear. His daughters, they make it out of desperation. They see no obvious solution to providing them with offspring, and so they do what is wrong and sinful, what they ought not do, out of desperation. So they're trying to get good results with bad decisions, okay? Don't do that, all right? Don't make decisions out of fear. If you know from Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So conversely, on the other side of the coin, when you have decisions that you're made out of fear of anything but the Lord, the consideration, the desire to please the Lord, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of anything else is the beginning of folly. It's the beginning of foolishness. It's the beginning of many troubles. And interestingly enough, this man, he goes, leaves the promised land to go to this place. And his name, we'll see in the next verse, was Elimelech, which means God is my king. He's from Bethlehem, and his name is Elimelech. Now, the names in the book of Ruth are important. Do you know what the name Bethlehem means? It means house of bread. He's fleeing from that place because, ironically, they don't have food. And his name is God is my king, but he's leaving the territory, so to speak. God is ruler of the whole earth. God, he doesn't leave God's presence. We know that from Psalm 139. You can't flee from God's presence. Yet he leaves the wings, so to speak, of God in search of bread. He leaves the house of bread in search of bread. And it doesn't give us indications of his motive or his thought process. We just know that he goes to Moab. Now, if you read some of the ancient Jewish writings like the Talmud and different things like that, the teachings of some of the rabbis, they teach that he, you know, he was sinning by leaving the promised land and by fleeing, you know, God's area, God's territory that he'd given them. So regardless of that, it seems like it's Bethlehem. The name Bethlehem is ironic here, as well as Elimelech, God is my king. And the names are significant. His name of his wife, Naomi. And the name of their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Naomi means pleasant or full. And the two sons, their names mean sickly and pining, more or less. Sickly and pining. That's not the greatest names to name your kids, you know. The names are significant here. And we have every indication that this is history, more historical than allegorical, meaning these are people that did live, these events did happen, but their names also are in a sense allegorical, meaning these names mean something to the story. So it's interesting that Elimelech names his children sickly and pining. Pining is like a yearning or a desire, an unfulfilled or unmet need that you just crave so much that you kind of wither away. And that's what happens. Interestingly enough, there's lots of prophecies about Moab in the Bible. And one that I want to point out is in Jeremiah 48. And I'm going to look that up. I was just going to kind of reference it, but I want to confirm. So Jeremiah's prophesying about Moab, and he's saying, oh man, that's a long chapter, isn't it? That's verse 11. Okay. I'll start at 10. Cursed is he who does the work of the Lord with slackness, and cursed is he who keeps back his sword from bloodshed. So he's saying the judgment of God is coming, and if you withhold that judgment, your participation in it, you'll be cursed. God has a judgment for Moab. Moab has been at ease from its youth and has settled on his dregs. He has not been emptied from vessel to vessel, nor has he gone into exile. So his taste remains in him, and his sin has not changed. Okay, that's kind of confusing. Settled on his dregs. He hasn't been emptied from vessel to vessel. This has to do with wine and winemaking. When wine was made, it was put into a vessel, and it was left in a vessel for a period of time. I'm not an expert on this, but you'll get the idea. And what would happen is the dregs would settle to the bottom. The bitter taste, sourness, undesirable characteristics of the wine would settle to the bottom, and it would be poured to another vessel carefully so that the dregs remained. And it would sit in this vessel, and the bitterness and the impurities would settle to the bottom, and it would be poured into another vessel. And what God is saying, Moab had been allowed to remain in their land. You know, Israel had gone at different times into exile. We see with Naomi, she's going into exile. And there's something interesting here, because Naomi later will find out renames herself Mara, which means bitterness. But it's also kind of an ironic naming, because Naomi moves from place to place. The bitterness, the dregs, sink in, and the desirable aspects are poured off the top. So have you heard somebody say, well, like in one of the Psalms, God says there's a cup the Lord has, and he's going to pour it out, and the people of the earth will drink it to its dregs. They're going to get every last piece of the judgment, every last piece of the bitterness. And so what's interesting here is God is saying the hard things that happen in our life that move us around, that make us uncomfortable, that feels like we're being poured out, actually, it's a purification process. The bitterness, the dregs, the impurities are left behind, and what comes out of it should be a better version until we are refined to a desirable outcome. Does that make sense? So to me, it's interesting because Naomi's name means pleasant, but she renames herself bitter, but the reverse is happening. The bitterness is going to be left behind, and the pleasantness is going to remain. She misinterprets what's happening in her life. So keep that in your mind, because that's tied to Moab, which is where they're from. And one thing I love about this book is that the namesake is this lady named Ruth, and she's a Moabitess. She's from Moab. So one of the criticisms that people might make about, you know, the Bible or religion or whatever is that it's an ethnocentric patriarchy. That might be a criticism labeled at it, meaning that it's focused on the supremacy or the desirability of one ethnicity. It's ethnocentric, centered on one group of people, and that it's a patriarchy, meaning dominated by males. And yet, to me, the inclusion of this book, it blows my mind. They picked this book was allowed to remain. You know, God, his hand was on it. This tells me God's hand was on the selection of the Bible, because you have an enemy of the people of Israel and a foreigner and a woman. And Moab was cursed because of the actions of Lot and his daughter. And even later they were cursed so that 10 generations weren't allowed into the assembly of the Lord. So what you have is a cursed outsider and a woman at that, who is the hero of this book and who God chooses to bring the line of Jesus. So just like the book of Noah, we see a surprising move of God to the outsider, to the foreigner, to the Gentile, to the outsider. And he's moving to redeem them. He's moving to bring them in. His plan all along was that they would be included. I think it's beautiful. Just that fact alone just makes me love God more. So she's a cursed outsider, yet she's the hero, and she's bought in. She's brought into the family. And God's working through her. So that halfway through verse 2, they were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. So at first they're going to sojourn. They're traveling, right? They're going as travelers, and yet they remain there. All right? So if you might, it's not hard to imagine that just like Lot was moving, he was reacting out of fear. Elimelech was making decisions based in fear rather than faith. And not only did he intended to sojourn, he remained there. He remained there. So he left, and then he remained. And when we make compromises based out of fear, we have to be careful that we don't remain in that place. We're going to see what Naomi does. They stay there 10 years. But don't remain in the place that you entered because of fear or because of compromise. While they were there, things did not get better, by the way, for them. It doesn't really mention if they found food or not, but things did not get better. So Elimelech left because of food, and maybe he found food, but conditions did not improve. And I'm telling you, if you run away from the Lord because you're dissatisfied in one area of your life, even if you find what satisfies that one area of your life, you will not find satisfaction. You won't find peace. You won't find happiness. You won't find joy. You won't find security. What happened was Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, not to be confused with Oprah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. So we have Naomi remaining. Now, we don't know what role Naomi played in the decision-making process. It says that the man, Elimelech, it seems to indicate he made the decision, and she followed along. And here she is. Her sons married Moabite women, which wasn't expressly forbidden, but is usually seen as a sign of falling away, a sign of unfaithfulness, because they had foreign gods They worshiped gods who, they practiced child sacrifice. And their sons drift farther from the Lord. So they go and sojourn, but they remain. And not only do they remain, but they intermarry. Now we're going to see God is not against like inter-ethnic marriages, because he sets one up later in the book. But the issue is faithfulness to God. And I think when we make compromises, our children suffer further. Their kids went farther in compromising than Elimelech did. And a lot of times it's about trajectory and the movement of our hearts. So Naomi is left with two daughters, daughters-in-law. Where do you put the S? I should know, right? No, I don't know. Okay, two daughters-in-law. Oh, it's right there in verse 6. She's in a vulnerable state, a vulnerable position. All right, she doesn't have a husband. She doesn't have sons. She doesn't have family. We're going to find out later there's no one that she recalls left in her family group. And she's in a foreign land. So she's extremely vulnerable. No resources, no protection, no people. And she arose, verse 6, with her daughters-in-law to return to the country, to return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal with you kindly as you have dealt with the dead and with me." So these women did have, you know, they did have a nobility or a morality. They dealt kindly with Naomi. They dealt kindly with, it says, the dead. They honored their deceased husbands. And Naomi blessed them. She said, "The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night, and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. What Naomi's saying is she's trying to get the daughters-in-law to return, and she's referencing Levirate marriage. I don't know how to pronounce that. A marriage that was established that if a woman marries a son, a husband, and he should pass away, the next oldest brother should marry her in order that his name could continue and bear offspring in his name for his inheritance. And what Naomi is saying, I don't have any more sons. Not only has my husband died and he doesn't have any family members, I don't have any sons that you could have. So even if I did have a husband and I had a child, would you really wait for him to be grown to remarry you as he would be your husband's brother? What Naomi is saying is there's zero hope. There's zero way. There's zero opportunity. All right? So Naomi here, in her distress, she said it's exceedingly bitter. She's actually wrong. She's either forgotten or doesn't know or doesn't remember. She doesn't have all the information, but she's saying there's no hope. But there is hope. We'll see. And a lot of times when we're in a bitter situation and we don't see any way out, we wrongly believe that the only solution is to compromise. That there's no way that we can walk and see things get better. Either there's zero hope or the only chance is to compromise. And with God, there is a way. And we're going to see it. Naomi says, And this is interesting, and this could be like, you could write a book on how to interpret this. She says, "No, my daughters, it is exceedingly bitter for me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." It's exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. And so, we don't know. It doesn't say, it doesn't give commentary to Naomi's words here. She's experiencing emotionally extreme bitterness, exceeding bitterness. Okay, we can verify. She's testifying that that's what she's experiencing, and we can believe her that the circumstances that she's going through are exceedingly bitter. And she says that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. All right, now I think how you interpret this, how you interpret hardship and suffering says, I mean, there's huge theological camps and debates and discussions about this, right? She says, God's hand has gone out against me. And in one way, I believe she's right. Okay? We don't live in a dualistic world. You know, there's some people that we think, because this is a book about God's providence and God's sovereignty. All right? And I'll try to make it simple. God and the devil are not on equal terms. They're not of equal strength. They're not of equal ability. They're not of equal knowledge. They're not of equal power. They're not of equal influence. It's not even close. Amen. It's not even close. It's not that everything bad that happens in the world is the fault of the devil, and everything that good happens is the consequence of the actions of God, and they're in conflict, and it's undetermined, or maybe it's determined, but there's an equal resistance. There's a battle going on. There is a battle going on, but there's no contest. You look at the life of Job. And everything that happens, everything that occurs, and this may be troubling, is at least permitted or ordained by God. He is sovereign. Now, you can do something. You can go a couple ways with that. You can say, well, if something bad happens and God allows it, then God must be bad. And there are people that come to that conclusion. Or they say, well, that would be bad, and so that therefore that God must not exist. And I believe Naomi feels like God is punishing her. And perhaps there's consequence to sin. There's consequence to action. There's consequence to the choices that we make. And you may be walking through the consequences of your decisions, of your actions and your choices. You may be suffering the consequences of other people's choices and actions and sin, and you may be suffering. But all Naomi saw was her suffering. It seems that. And she didn't see. The songs that we sang, When All I See is the Mountain, how'd that go, Chris? When all I see is the mountain, you see the mountain move. What was before that? You see my victory when all I see is a battle. That song is fitting because all Naomi can see is I'm going through an exceedingly bitter time and God's hand is against me. And at that same exact moment, God's hand is working on her behalf to redeem and to rescue her. And I love what Naomi does. And I think this, we don't get an elaborate, thought out, monologue from her or an aside of how she's thinking through this. But we see in her actions, what does she do? What does she plan to do? She's already taking steps. She's planning to return. She's planning to return. She's returning to the Lord. Not that perhaps she was faithful the whole time, but she's returning to the promised land. She's returning. She's not running further from the Lord. You know, I see a lot in different ways, the book of Jonah. Jonah gets a call from God and he runs away, right? Until, you know, he goes through some hardship and eventually he returns and carries out his actions. Naomi, despite how she feels about what's happening, I think she does trust God. And she returns. She doesn't run farther away. She doesn't sit down and have a pity party. She doesn't collapse and crumble in her grief. She doesn't compromise. But all she can see and all she can feel is the negative emotion, the bitterness. But she doesn't sin in that. I think she's to be commended. Verse 15. I don't know if I explained that good enough. But there's some people who say God never makes anything bad happen or allows anything bad to happen. It's all the devil. God can lead us through hardship. And it's that pouring from vessel to vessel. It's letting the dregs settle. And it's a refining process. God will allow us or lead us into hardship, into difficulty, perhaps into suffering. He will ultimately deliver us, but he's refining us. And he's with us. Verse 15, and she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods." That's Orpah. Orpah returned. And so there's a lot at stake here. Not only is it just like Orpah's making a decision here. You know, it could seem like she's making a decision just not to go with Naomi, to return to her people. But there's more going on behind the scenes. She's returning to her gods. And sometimes we think a decision's based on one thing or about one thing, but it's really signifying the condition and the state of our heart. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you." These are very popular words, or very famous, well-known, I guess, words. "For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. Ruth doesn't speak that often in this book. Other people have more words. Yet these are powerful words. And she's either expressing a decision that she had already made, or she's making a decision and making it clear. And she says in the center of that, "Your God will be my God. Your God will be my God." She's deciding to follow the Lord. She's deciding to follow the Lord, the God of Israel. "Your God will be my God." And I think we're going to look, if you skip to verse chapter 2 real quick. I don't want to give too much away. Chapter 2, verse 12. Good things happen. Good things are on the horizon. Naomi forgot that there's relatives that can fulfill the role that she thought no one was left to fulfill. And Ruth is going to ask Boab, "Why are you being kind to me?" And he says in verse 12, "The Lord is repaying you. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." I think that's a beautiful picture of saving faith, right? God is rewarding her. God is remaining faithful to her. She's come under his wings. She's gone under his wings for refuge. She's gone into his territory, into his protection. She's drawn near to God, and he's working on her behalf. We see a return. Naomi is physically returning, but it's like they're drawing near to God. What we do in the physical is often an indication of what's going on in the spiritual. The actions we take, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, the decisions we make. And Ruth, at some point, had entered into the wings, under the wings of God. She'd made a faith decision to trust the Lord. I think that's a beautiful picture of salvation. And so she's an outsider, a cursed outsider, and a female at that. And yet she puts herself under the protection of God Almighty, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And she is safe. And out of that decision, friends, she can act in courageous kindness. I think that's what gave her the power to make that decision, to leave her people, to go to enemy territory, a foreign land with where it's unknown, to commit herself to Naomi, to die beside her, let nothing but death separate us. Because she had known God's grace, she had trusted the Father, she was able to make difficult decisions. And I think in today's times, what's needed the most out of God's people is a courageous, self-sacrificing kindness. You know the words of Jesus, he said, if you try to save your life, imagine if I wish Lot could have known this. If you try to save your life, you'll lose it. I wish Elimelech could have known this. If you try to save your life, you'll lose it. What does it prosper a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? But if you give up your life, if you lay down your life for the sake of God, if you lay down your life for the Lord, you'll be saved. You'll save it. You'll find it. And that's going to be played out in Ruth. She lays down her life, and she finds abundant life that Jesus promised. She's going to find that John 10:10 life. She's going to walk in abundance. She sees no way. She sees no hope. She's going to do the right thing. I was thinking about it and talking about it this morning, and a song came in my mind, a song lyric. And I was praying on the way in, and it says, basically, I have it on my phone so I could read it to you, okay? Wisdom, I'm going to play it for you here in a second as we go into communion. It's this guy, Josh Garrels, he's a really brilliant songwriter. He's from Indiana. He said, wisdom will honor everyone who will learn to listen, to love, to pray and discern, and to do the right thing even when it burns. And to live in the light through each treacherous turn. I love that line. To do the right thing even when it burns. We see Ruth doing that, and I believe that she had the power to do that because she had known the love of God. She'd experienced God's love. She'd come under his wings. So in verse 19, I'll wrap up. The two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. They returned, and the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? She said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? Okay, so we see this tension here in the sense of, she doesn't see hope. She only feels empty. And she feels that God has done this to her. And yet, even then, it seems that she's making the right decisions. I've known a lot of people who can say the right things and then make the wrong decisions. What impresses me about the people of Israel is they get hammered. And there's always a remnant who in that suffering returns to the Lord. It doesn't make them rebel further. There's a remnant who takes the suffering, who takes the punishment, who takes the discipline of the Lord and returns to him. And what you see is that pouring from vessel to vessel, the settling of the dregs. And God, he keeps a remnant. There's a remnant of the wine that remains until it's purified. And there's a remnant of his people who can go through hardship and remain faithful to him. And he purifies them. Naomi's redemption is on her doorstep, and she doesn't see it. And she has all kinds of feelings about it, and they're not good. She doesn't curse the Lord. I see her very much as like a Job figure here. She said, God did this. God's allowed this. God's brought this about. This is happening. I went away full. I came back empty. But she doesn't curse God. And she doesn't use it as an opportunity to sin. And she returns. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. That's the end of chapter 1. That's where I'm stopping today. Okay? But we have two different characters here, especially in Naomi and Ruth. And we don't know Ruth's emotional state. We don't know how she's feeling, but she's made the courageous and kind decision, shocking really, to commit her life to following Naomi. And God is going to honor that. And she gives the opportunity for the Lord to do his thing. Naomi doesn't turn her back on God. She doesn't sin in her frustration with the Lord. And so I want you to take encouragement. If you're in a situation that to you is exceedingly bitter, if you're sitting in a situation and all you feel is bitterness, and you maybe it's not even the choice of your actions, Naomi just was a participant, as far as we know, in the decisions of Elimelech, the decisions of her son, although she had influence. And what's interesting, women, is those women named in the genealogy of Jesus, they use their feminine wiles, you might say, to bring about, to help usher what God was doing and to encourage men to do the right thing, perhaps. And so we're going to see that Ruth has a hand in the redemption. God is doing the work. She participates with them through her courage and through her kindness. We're going to see her character is top-notch. But if you're going through something, I want you to press on. I don't want you to turn your back on the Lord. Maybe he's just purifying you. It could be a result of your actions. Do not make decisions in fear, in any fear, except the fear of the Lord. Do not make decisions with any consideration, out of desperation. You may solve that one little problem you have in your life, but you might find yourself with a whole lot of other problems. Don't compromise integrity. Don't use your situation as an excuse to sin, but remain faithful. Throw yourself under his wings, like Ruth did, and make courageous decisions with a heart of kindness. That's a good book. It gets better, all right? Maybe like Naomi has no idea that she's on the verge of a breakthrough. She has no clue. She doesn't see it. She doesn't see any opportunity. She doesn't see any possibility. Yet God is behind the scenes working. And I believe that's true for us as well. So I asked Chase, did it work out? I want to have a song as we go into communion. I'm sure we have a communion song as well. But I looked this song up, and I've known it for a long time. And some of the lines, he said, it just fits. I wonder if he was thinking about Ruth. Probably not. But he said, plumbing the depths to a place in between, the tangible world and the land of a dream. Because everything here ain't quite what it seems. There's more beneath the appearance of things. That was Naomi's situation. And it says, a beggar could be king within the shadows of a wing. Okay? Ruth, Naomi, they return as beggars. And yet, Ruth helps give birth to a king. Not only David, but King Jesus. So who knows what could happen under God's wings, under his protection, when you run to him for salvation. Despite her bitterness, Naomi drew near to the Lord. She returned, and God worked. And what's crazy about it, in that song, so lift your voice just one more time. If there's any hope, may it be a sign that everything was made to shine despite what we can see. So take this bread and drink this wine and hide your spirit in the vine where all things work by good design for those who will believe. It's like it was made for this message. It leads into communion. So we're going to play this song, use it as a meditation, and then the worship team can continue to play music. After this song's over, then you can take communion. Let me pray. God, I pray that we would be people of courageous kindness, people of integrity, people like Ruth who will work hard with character and integrity, with kindness and love, with honesty, and that you would work on our behalf. Whatever situation we're facing, God, pray that we could trust you, that we wouldn't respond in fear to any consideration except the fear of the Lord. And that you, it would be the beginning of wisdom. We would walk in wisdom, and that the world would be saved, that people would come to know you, that people would return to you, God, that you would work miracles and bring about your purposes, that we would see your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, as we walk with courage, trusting you. May we run to the shelter of your wings, God. We run to the cross. We run to your protection. As we get ready to take communion, God, may we consider it that you, your Father, that you didn't even hold back your Son. That he who didn't, I'm going to misquote Romans, but he who didn't withhold his Son, how much more will he give us all that we need? You didn't hold back your best. You'll give us the rest that we need. So as we study this book, Lord, may we begin to know you, to love you, to trust you, and then to work with you to see your kingdom come. We pray in Jesus' name. I think the lyrics are up there, yeah.